This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, finding workers has become a problem in many Illinois communities, and it's not just bars and restaurants that are struggling to fill positions. We'll hear more. Illinois is planning a name change for the Asian carp. The idea is to make the fish more popular with consumers. We'll talk with some residents of a senior living community to hear what life was like for them during the pandemic.
Those of us in this building are not looking forward to decades, and it puts a different spin on the way you look at life. This last 15 months has definitely impacted the way we view time.
Lincoln's foreign policy gets examined by an author. We'll talk with him, and we'll look back at a central Illinois city's punk rock scene in the 1980s and 90s. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a lot of businesses are happy to get back open, but finding enough workers is proving a challenge. Also, Abraham Lincoln, we know the role he played in the U.S., but what about other countries? We'll examine Lincoln's foreign policy. And with schools looking to expand mental health services, some are turning to man's best friend to help. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. At the end of this month, Illinoisans will no longer hear the words Asian carp. After several years and hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars spent trying to keep them from the Great Lakes, how can that be? And why does the news have environmentalists and the state's commercial fishing industry swimming with optimism? Para Schutz from the program Chicago Tonight brings us that story.
Dirk Fusick is the purveyor of Dirk's Fish and Gourmet Shop. He says Asian carp may one day be more popular than tilapia.
And I think it's a better fish than tilapia. It's healthier than tilapia. Tilapia is omega-6 fish instead of an omega-3 fish, so you get a lot less benefits of health from tilapia.
To prove his point, Fusick is grilling up some creative carp cuisine, from carp Cuban burgers to carp tacos to regular old smoked carp. But despite the accoutrement, the Asian carp is not yet a bestseller.
I'm not making any money on it at this point in time.
As you may know, Asian carp are the leaping, invasive fish that have taken Illinois waterways by storm. Governments have spent hundreds of millions of dollars keeping them out of the Great Lakes for fear they could destroy the lake's ecosystem. But now, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources believes it may have found a fix, and it costs next to nothing. They are going to change the fish's name.
We're trying to make the name more attractive so that people be more inclined to purchase these fish and try them and have them as table fare, have them for dinner.
So what exactly is wrong with the name Asian carp?
You made a face when you said carp, so.
A typical carp is a bottom feeder, a smelly, gooey fish that isn't appetizing to anyone. Asian carp, however, feed on plankton and are not like other carp.
As far as freshwater fish, if they're prepared right, probably about as good as it gets.
We visited commercial fishermen Dave Buchanan and Clint Carter on a recent morning, hauling in 4,000 pounds worth of Asian carp and other fish in the Peoria Pool part of the Illinois River. Carter says he recently invested in a new boat and fishing equipment, hoping the name change leads to a coming boom in demand.
It'll help us expand our business and concentrate on harvesting these fish.
Right now, commercial fishermen get a government subsidy to fish Asian carp out of the Illinois River to help control a massive population that has moved in and taken over.
Some of these fish are destined for fertilizer or other industrial uses, but others, especially the bighead carp, could soon be on your dinner plate.
That is, once they have an enticing new name. As for the criteria,
something simple and short, and not carp, you know?
And there is precedent for this. Chilean sea bass was initially called Patagonian toothfish. Orange ruffy, initially known as Pacific slimehead. After a typically productive day in the Peoria pool, Dave and Clint haul their load to Source Freshwater Company, a Peoria-based fish processor and distributor. Owner Roy Source says he pivoted his business 9 months ago after 50 years distributing food and dry goods. He, too, is betting big on the name change.
Right now, we've already created probably 30 to 40 new jobs just in the first 9 months, mainly through the fishermen.
Source says the meat is lily white and plentiful, but there's one more impediment to culinary success.
The one bad thing about carp is that it's bony, and I can't give you an 8-ounce boneless piece of carp. So it has to be processed into, ground up into something. So it can be burgers, sausages, hot dogs, meatballs, taco meat, anything you can think of with ground meat.
Which brings us back to our taste test. First, the carp burgers.
Here we go. Carpe diem. Very good.
Next, the Asian carp fish taco.
It's really, really good.
And finally, smoked Asian carp.
I mean, right. Tastes like smoked fish,
right?
And the reviews were mostly satisfactory among customers.
The general impression I had were they were sort of throwaway fish, but it tastes fine.
Illinois public officials will reveal the name change on June 29th, hoping seafood lovers protect Illinois waterways and the Great Lakes from an aggressive, invasive species by eating loads of it. This is Paris Schutz.
Even though only 3% of Americans are currently farmers, a lot of people still identify as part of the agriculture lifestyle, and that community has found a home in a video game. From Harvest Public Media, Jonathan All reports.
Harley Hand is getting ready for a day on the farm.
Well, first, let me jump in a combine. We've got a soybean harvest, guys. We've got a big harvest, a bunch of fields that are ready to go.
He makes an adjustment to his equipment, and he's on his way.
Need to unfold the header. I guess it's okay. Well, let's fold it up. There we go. All right, let's roll.
But that sound, not a real combine. The Georgia native isn't really behind the controls of a big machine at all. He isn't even on a farm. He's in front of his computer in his house playing the game Farming Simulator and streaming the session online, where he regularly gets hundreds of people watching him play. Hand says a lot of his interactions with his audience are about learning the ins and outs of farming.
It's a huge learning experience for a lot of people that come into my streams. I've got a lot of people that know nothing about farming, and they come into the stream and they're like, oh, really? That's how that works. And it's pretty cool.
Farming Simulator covers a lot of ground, from buying equipment to choosing crops, plowing, planting, fertilizing, and harvesting. A.K. Ramig is a gamer and writer who reviewed Farming Simulator for the website PC Invasion. He says the game is a lot like real farming.
The monotony, the tediousness, the length of time that it takes to plow a field in Farming Sim, it does give you an appreciation for what real farmers have to do, I would say, from my experience.
Monotony, tediousness, not the words you want to associate with something that people would do for fun. But Ramig, who lives in the Bahamas, says the game still has a lot of appeal.
And we don't have major scale farming here. You'll never see a John Deere tractor here, right? But it's still cool to me. It's still cool to see machines.
The game's so popular, playing it can actually be a full-time job. Harley Hand and several other streamers play the game online almost daily with hundreds of people watching. There's also a Farming Simulator esports competition that has sponsored teams competing for cash prizes up to $250,000, a lot more than what most farmers make in a year. And some of the game's most avid fans are farmers. Shelby Walker is a Southern Illinois native and a PhD candidate in agriculture communications at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Her research shows some people who drive a real tractor all day will unwind by driving a virtual one.
The conditions aren't always perfect, but within the game, the conditions are always perfect. So it's almost like this fantasy. It's I get to do things in the digital realm that I don't get to do in real life.
She says it's a form of escapism to do it in a more predictable environment. Walker says the game also attracts people who may not be farmers, but feel connected to agriculture. That idea checks with streamer Harley Hand. He says all that tedious and monotonous time driving a combine, it allows him to connect with his audience.
A game like Farming Simulator allows you to interact with the people who are watching you a lot better than you can play in a game like Call of Duty. So it really, it becomes, you know, you're building a bunch of friendships and you begin to know everybody that's there.
Like here, when Hand reads a comment in his chat about a viewer who recently lost his home due to financial problems.
I hate to hear that, brother. Hopefully, you know, hopefully there's a turnaround somewhere, man. I'm sorry to hear that, brother. Hopefully everything gets better for you, dude.
Farming Simulator is scheduled to release a new version late this year. There's much speculation on whether it will add new features to make it even more realistic or keep it simple to attract a wider audience. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Restaurant managers aren't the only employers struggling to hire workers these days. From Bloomington Normal, Eric Stock reports many businesses are in competition for new employees as the economy reopens.
Several of the area's largest employers have announced major hiring sprees this year, including State Farm and electric vehicle maker Rivian. But there are many others hiring, too, as pandemic restrictions ease. Bloomington Normal has added close to 5,000 jobs since the height of the pandemic shutdowns in March of last year. And by the looks of it, the hiring spree isn't slowing anytime soon.
You go around Bloomington Normal, there's now hiring signs up everywhere you look.
That's Jeremy Gray. He's the plant manager at Bridgestone in Normal. Bridgestone is hiring 30 workers to boost production of tires for industrial and mining equipment. Gray says demand for Bridgestone's off-the-road tires has gradually increased since January.
We started the year producing just slightly under what we had budgeted, but demand's picked up to the point now where we need to be producing at levels, production levels higher than what we budgeted, and we expect that to continue for the remainder of this year.
Those 30 jobs will get Bridgestone back to pre-pandemic staffing. Other companies are hiring over and above previous workforce levels. Ellen Hook is chief operating officer at Ashley Home Store in Bloomington. The furniture business is looking to hire more sales reps and office staff. Hook says Ashley did well during the pandemic. More people working from home decided it was time to spruce up their living and work quarters. And thanks to stimulus checks, they were able to do it.
Some people got hit really hard, and some people actually thrived during the pandemic and had more discretionary income.
The pandemic caused other lifestyle changes for people with extra money and time on their hands. Andy Shirk is president of Beer Nuts in Bloomington.
People stayed home, they drank a little bit more beer, they snacked a little bit more on Beer Nuts, and that was helpful for us.
Shirk says demand for Beer Nuts products has grown nationwide. They have 8 open positions. Beer Nuts and Ashley Home Store were among more than 50 employers at a job fair outside Eastland Mall in Bloomington. Uniform and cleaning company Cintas Corporation also looked for new workers at the job fair. Cintas has 14 open positions. Human resource manager Penny Darnall says filling those jobs has been a struggle.
Not easy. We don't have a lot of people applying, so we have some coming through, but not near the volume that we used to have.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think people just, I think the COVID epidemic, you know, definitely, you know, made an impact on what people wanted to do and who they wanted to be around, and I think that's been a concern for sure.
Darnall says it's been especially hard to fill the jobs that require physical labor. Other employers offer different reasons for the worker shortage. Greg Bacon is general manager of the Kong Skilled Industries plant in Normal, where they make specialty equipment for plastic, paper, and packaging industries. Bacon says the company wants to expand, but hiring has been tough, especially when Rivian Automotive has been on a hiring spree. Bacon says there are only so many skilled workers to go around.
That's kind of been a trend, I think, for a while now. But the intensity of that has just raised, you know, I would say just in the last few months to the point where I think we're going to see pay level coming up quite a bit across the board in order to accommodate that and to attract more people into the trades.
Bacon says the company's increased pay 30% to fill its open positions, and some employers looking for hired help have turned to staffing agencies. Megan Lucas is the Bloomington branch manager at Manpower. Lucas says there are all kinds of jobs in demand, in restaurants, manufacturers, and warehouses. Clerical jobs are also easy to find. Lucas says her office has nearly three times as many clients on jobs now as it did a year ago, but she says it's still a struggle for some employers. Lucas blames expanded unemployment benefits as the main reason workers are hard to find, but she says a lack of child care and COVID concerns have also kept some from returning to work. Lucas says Manpower recruiters advise not to sit out too long, even if it's to your short-term advantage.
In September, when the benefits of unemployment are up, they're not going to be making as much money off unemployment as they would in an actual career path, and just showing kind of how a career would suit them and their family situation better than wanting them to continue staying on the couch.
Some employers have responded to the tight hiring market by offering better pay. Ashley Homestore has boosted pay for office staff to between $12 and $15 per hour. COO Ellen Hook says the company also pledges $1,500 bonuses for hiring referrals, and sales reps get commission for written sales. Sales reps get their money much faster that way, especially since most furniture deliveries now take 3 to 4 months. Other employers say raising pay is not that easy. Penny Darnall at Cintas says the company increased pay months before the pandemic started. She hopes the company will raise pay again soon.
That is something we are definitely looking into. That's something we would like. We're working with corporate on that now.
Trevor Brothers is HR manager at Bridgestone in Normal. He says wage negotiations will have to wait until next year when the current labor agreement expires.
It's not as flexible or as easy to just jump into something like that comparative to a facility that does not have a union contract.
But Brothers says Bridgestone has offered other incentives, including retention and referral bonuses. The tire maker also has cast a wider net through digital and radio advertising to find job candidates. Andy Shirk at Beer Nut says the company has increased wages 60% for its lowest paying positions. Beer Nuts is moving some of its distribution to Bloomington from a plant in Michigan. Shirk says it's a competitive hiring market, but that's okay. He says it'll force employers to make their jobs more attractive.
As a community, we're seeing the bar being raised for employers to create a better place for people to work, and I think that's a good thing on the whole.
Employers may have to keep offering more perks to find the workers they need as long as they remain this bullish on an economic recovery. I'm Eric Stock.
We have more of Statewide on the way. We'll hear how some senior citizens made it through the pandemic. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, we'll find out about the city of Peoria's punk rock scene in the 80s and 90s. We'll talk with the author of a new book that examines that period. Well, the pandemic has been especially extreme for residents in senior living communities. Earlier this spring, WBEZ visited with some of those individuals at a Chicago facility known as the Admiral at the Lake, after most people there were fully vaccinated. The residents are looking ahead to the future, but also reflecting on what life has been like over the past year.
We would wake up, eat a box of cereal that had been delivered in the meal bag the night before. I would say after breakfast,
we read. What else do we? We were in the apartment.
Yeah, we were in the apartment essentially all day.
We have beautiful views. We see the joggers, the bikers, and the weather. Every day is different. Every day is extraordinary.
I'm Hank Bliss. I'm 82 years old. I've been at the Admiral for 8.5 years.
And I'm Joan Bliss, and I've been here for the same amount of time. We were extremely fortunate in that we had a dog. The dog gave us access to the outdoors, and he has brought us much joy. And we think we've brought him much joy. There's been a gradual opening up. I'm delighted to come out of my cocoon now, but while we were in essentially total hermit mode, it wasn't dreadful, but we were lucky. And as soon as the fitness went on the TV, we did fitness 5 days a week.
Katie Cavanaugh has been a godsend to us.
From tapping my toe back, it can be little, it can be big. Arms are swinging back and forth. hips, working on hips.
My name is Katie Cavanaugh. I am a full-time employee here. I'm a group fitness instructor.
Ready? March it. Ready with the arms. Roll back.
It's been wonderful. Now people are coming out more, doing more, going into the pool. Social events are happening. The first time people came down here, it was just kind of a shock for me. It's so just rewarding to see people and be able to have contact with them.
Okay, which way do you want to go?
No problem.
Let's go that way. Okay. When the pandemic started, we started walking every day. And we have not missed a single day. In fact, I probably shouldn't say this. The reason we meet on the sixth floor is we were not sure we were allowed to be outside. So we were kind of sneaking out through the alley when we first started. I'm Pat Martino. I moved to the Admiral in 2012 with my husband. And he is in the harbors. And there was a year and 6 days from when they threw me out of the harbor until I could visit with him and give him a haircut. When they told me I could visit, I started crying. I'm sorry.
The way the regulations and guidance have been written for communities like ours is to protect the physical health and well-being of the resident as a singular focus. They lost sight of the whole person. What was asked of them was not right. I mean, it was right in the standpoint of keeping people alive and healthy. It was not right, though. And those effects are going to be in play for a long time. And for many, unfortunately, it will never revert back.
Those of us in this building are not looking forward to decades, and it puts a different spin on the way you look at life. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no question.
This last 15 months has definitely impacted the way we view time and the way we view the future and the way we value the present, particularly the healthy present.
An audio postcard from seniors who reside at the Admiral at the Lake in Chicago. It was produced by Courtney Kippers. Dr. Lewis Katz will be keeping a close eye on COVID-19 statistics over the summer. The medical director of the Scott County, Iowa Health Department says the number of cases in the Quad Cities has been falling, and the number of people hospitalized with the coronavirus has also dropped. Still, Michelle O'Neill reports that Katz continues to encourage everyone who's eligible to get vaccinated.
Dr. Katz is very reluctant to even hint that soon the Quad Cities might be out of the woods when it comes to COVID-19. Yes, he's pleased the number of cases in Scott County has dropped to less than 5 per 100,000 people, and he's glad more than 43% of the population is fully vaccinated. But Katz cautions those who haven't been vaccinated to wear a mask, social distance, and keep following all the CDC guidelines. Here's one glimmer of hope. For the first time during the pandemic, Katz says there was no surge in case counts after the most recent holiday, Memorial Day.
That's really good evidence that we've reached a level of immunity in the population, primarily from immunization, but also those people who have already been infected, where we did what we did on Memorial Day, all outdoors, of course, or mostly outdoors, and we didn't get a surge. With the caveats, the cautions, unvaccinated people should continue as we have been for the last 18 months, essentially. And immunosuppressed people need to be careful. Otherwise, if you're vaccinated, you're in pretty good shape.
For those who choose not to be vaccinated, Katz says it's not wise to just hope that if you catch COVID-19, you'll develop immunity.
The treatments that we have aren't very effective, so I wouldn't want to get infected assuming that I was going to do okay or that treatment was going to save my life. So let me put it in a little context. Between 350 and 400 people are dying a day in the U.S. from COVID. Now, this in June, almost 400 people a day on average. And the other thing that I think is almost certainly true and will be proven over the next weeks and months is that the immunity from immunization may be stronger than the immunity from infection, and that the strength of the immunity from immunization may in fact be the absolute key to preventing the evolution, selection, and spread of new variants.
He also encourages the unvaccinated to be kind and think of others, especially since COVID-19 is 5 to 10 times more fatal than the common flu.
Presuming that we live in communities where we give a damn about each other, I needed to be immunized. If I didn't care about myself and my wife, I needed to be immunized because of all the other people I have to come into contact with, some of whom cannot get the vaccine or don't respond optimally to the vaccine. My evidence-based opinion is there's no safety concern that should prevent people from being immunized.
The number of COVID-19 inpatients in Quad Cities hospitals has fallen to single digits.
I've only in the last week been happy with really definitely convincing me that what I'm seeing in the epidemic curve is perfectly appropriate. So the curve started to convince me that we were on the right track 2-3 weeks ago, and it's in the last week or so that the counts in the hospital have shown sustained week-by-week falls, and everything makes sense. So, you know, I'm very conservative, and the glass is always half empty, but now it's half full.
For now, that's as close as we're going to get to hearing Dr. Katz express optimism about COVID-19 in the Quad Cities. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Most states don't allow trans people to correct their names on marriage certificates, even after going through a legal name change. Christine Hatfield reports legislators and advocates hope to make Illinois the second state to permit marriage certificate name changes.
Cato Lindholm says he's had a fairly good experience as a trans man living in the Chicago suburbs. He says he feels like he really hasn't had problems until he needed to get his name changed on his marriage certificate.
When the whole marriage certificate came about, suddenly it was a roadblock and it couldn't be done. And, you know, I did not understand that, to be honest.
Lindholm has to use his marriage certificate to prove he's married to his partner so he can go on his partner's health insurance. He says the barrier adds emotional stress to the process.
Every time, you know, you get that little bit of sweat, you get that little bit of, okay, I have to out myself. Will this work? And that's why this is important. I shouldn't have to go through that process.
Lindholm says he knows government can be slow, but it should be there to serve people.
If you make demands on trans people to make sure the documents are correct, then you also have to make all the documents available. That's basically how I see it.
And that's how State Senator Sarah Feigenholz of Chicago sees it. She's the Senate sponsor on the bill that would make it possible for trans people to get their marriage certificates changed to the right name.
This is really just an alignment thing. You know, your marriage certificate, your birth certificate, all these important documents have to reflect the same thing.
The bill would make it so county clerks have to issue a new marriage certificate when they receive legal documents indicating a name change. Feigenholz says it's ridiculous to limit how people can get their documents aligned.
Marriage certificates that limit, like, choices to bride and groom or force people to take their dead name and use it or to keep it and have it around, it's not a reflection of who they are or what their marriage looks like today.
The bill could also help eliminate some of the stigma and discrimination trans people face. That's according to Mike Zeri, the director of public policy with LGBTQ advocacy group Equality Illinois.
It's being able to reduce those barriers, the possible harassment that would come from having all your other documents aligned except the marriage certificate.
Other advocates say this proposal is such a small thing compared to the other issues trans people can face. Elizabeth Ricks is a legal director and staff attorney with the organization Chicago House, which runs the Trans Life Care Program.
We have trained people to consider it a gift just to have legislation that makes it so you don't get murdered as easily, right? There isn't expansive, thriving legislation encouraging people's lives and breaking out of the system of laws written by cis people through a cis lens.
Cisgender people are people who identify with the gender they were assigned at birth. Rick says when efforts to fix the marriage certificate law started, no state allowed for name changes on those documents. California eventually became the first state to allow marriage certificate name changes. Rick says laws like those aren't creating special privileges. She says they're including people who've been left out up to this point.
We have a very narrow set of laws that only fit a narrow set of people, and we have a lot of catching up to do to make laws that make sense for everyone.
Rick says she hopes other states will follow Illinois' lead.
I think we're really lucky to be in Illinois where we can do these forward-moving bills that go and fill in these gaps instead of always having to play defense like our colleagues in other states where trans kids are being denied health care and access to educational activities.
As for Senator Feigenholz, she says she wants to keep taking steps ahead for the trans community in Illinois so people can live a life that reflects their identity.
We're fully aware that the trans community has taken a really huge burden.
The bill passed the Illinois House and Senate on bipartisan votes in April and May, respectively. It awaits a potential signature from Governor J.B. Pritzker. I'm Christine Hatfield.
Youthful discontent sprung a small but vibrant punk rock scene in 1980s and 90s Peoria. The River City's DIY counterculture of years past is documented in a new book, Punks in Peoria. Yeah. Tim Shelley talked with the authors Jonathan Wright and Dawson Barrett.
The bulk of the book starts really in the early 80s and mostly takes place in the 80s and 90s into the early 2000s. So obviously in the 80s, the landscape there was, you know, strikes at Caterpillar, 20% unemployment rate, the decline of the industrial Midwest, which, you know, we weren't even really cognizant of that happening at the time. It's really only looking back in hindsight that becomes clear. In the 90s, when we came up, or I'm a few years older than Dawson, I kind of got into the scene in around 1994. There was, you know, one coffee shop in town, One World, that had literally just started. And there was, you know, a couple of record stores, but and a skateboard shop, but there weren't really a lot of institutions that people like us could really attach ourselves to and find others. So we kind of connected at record stores. I worked at the Co-op Records in East Peoria from 94 to 96. And that's where I really met like almost all of my friends in the Peoria scene. That's how I got into it. It's how I started doing shows. I think the theme is really that there wasn't a lot of infrastructure in Peoria. I don't know, Dawson, you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I would also say that we're writing this book from the perspective of adults, and we're trying to get back into the minds of you know, teenagers and people in their early 20s. And so your perspective of what a city has to offer changes a lot. And I think that's important, that we talk a bit in the book about how this is about a love-hate relationship with your hometown. And I think that rings true.
If we could talk a little bit about some of the bands back then, some of what they recorded, and I mean, what can we get from that?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that we use the word punk very loosely. It really defines more of a subculture and a DIY approach. You know, the lack of infrastructure to build a scene. There's punk music, which this obviously entailed, but it was much broader than that. It encompassed indie rock and ska and even like, you know, folk musicians and electronic musicians. And so it's really more of a mindset, I think, than the sound. But the sound is important too. We have this compilation record that's coming out alongside the book that'll be available on vinyl and CD. The first side is a lot of the earlier kind of real punk rock bands out of Peoria. Some of the early, in fact, the earliest, and some of the major players there. But you can kind of, as you listen to the record, you can kind of hear that musical journey as people started actually learning how to play their instruments, expanding on that kind of that punk ethic and broadening the musical horizons.
Anything else that either of you want to add? You want to talk about the book or anything in general?
I think many people, when they imagine punk rock, they think of it as destructive or self-destructive. And I think that element is certainly there. But what we found in researching and writing this book is that this is really a history of young people, you know, building something together and trying to improve the world around them. and doing so more or less from scratch.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the key themes of the book, and kind of, you know, that duality with your hometown, the love-hate relationship. You know, I think there's more love than hate, for sure. You know, you can be critical of certain aspects of your hometown, but then you also come to appreciate a lot of it.
That's Jonathan Wright and Dawson Barrett, and they spoke with Tim Shelley about their new book, Punks in Peoria. It came out this week. We'll stick around. Lincoln's foreign policy. We'll have that discussion on the way here on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, a furry four-legged friend can help schools looking for new ways to provide more mental health services. We'll have that story. Well, up next, we hear about Abraham Lincoln. We've done lots of interviews about him and talked to a lot of authors, but Kevin Perino touched on a topic rarely discussed when it comes to Lincoln, how he handled foreign policy and his influence around the world. His book, Lincoln in the World, came out a few years ago. We spoke with him at that time, and we revisit that conversation today.
I had been covering foreign affairs as a foreign correspondent at the street level for a long time in places like Syria and Libya and Yemen. And I went through a period where I really found myself wanting to step back and take kind of a broader look at foreign affairs, to look at some of the frameworks of American foreign policy, the traditions of American foreign policy. I came across this period, the mid-19th century, and the diplomacy of the Civil War, and I was just kind of sucked in. I mean, you've got Lincoln's minister to Russia, Cassius Marcellus Clay, is this character who walks around the streets of St. Petersburg with Bowie knives dangling from his waistband and getting in fist fights. I mean, the characters are like something out of a novel. But for whatever reason, there hadn't been a holistic human account of Lincoln's role in international affairs in nearly 70 years, which is before the Lincoln Papers were even released in 1947. And so there's a lot of water under the bridge since then.
Well, it's surprising to me on one hand, because you see so many things written about Lincoln that people have not addressed this part of his administration. At the same time, that period of time when such focus was being put on the domestic front because of the Civil War and other tensions that were going on in the U.S., I guess maybe it's not so surprising.
Right. Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One is the one that you just pointed out, that you know, we think of the Civil War as a domestic conflict, and it was, and so that just sucked up a lot of the oxygen when you're talking about the Civil War and Lincoln. But the other thing is that Lincoln had a very strong and competent Secretary of State in William Henry Seward, and he delegated a lot of daily foreign affairs business to Seward. So if you put Lincoln right at the center of his own foreign policy, you end up with a hagiography, because Lincoln didn't do everything in international affairs. But the things that Lincoln did do were really important. And so what I've done is taken a kind of an episodic approach and looked at some of those things that Lincoln did do in international affairs without saying that he did every single thing.
Well, give us an idea of what Lincoln was involved with and sort of his views on the U.S. and its role on the world stage.
Right. Well, the biggest thing that Lincoln had to deal with is to keep the European powers, primarily Britain and France, from intervening on the side of the Confederacy, which could have changed the course of the war. And he was successful to a large degree at that. But he also had to deal with a series of discrete crises, diplomatic crises, with Spain, with France, with Britain, throughout the course of the war. And just to give you one example, the French Emperor, Napoleon III, invaded Mexico in the early days of the Civil War, conquered Mexico City in 1863, and installed his puppet on the Mexican throne a year later. This is something we kind of forget about during the Civil War, that there was this major challenge to the Monroe Doctrine just south of the Rio Grande, and that was something that Lincoln had to deal with, and I think ultimately he dealt with very successfully.
We're speaking with author Kevin Perino. He is author of Lincoln in the World. Were you surprised on anything you found out about Lincoln? Did you go into this with an idea of what you would discover? Were there some real surprises, though, that came out?
I was surprised by a lot, but it wasn't the kind of surprise, you know, Lincoln had slaves or something that, you know, turns your idea of Lincoln and the Civil War upside down. The great scholar of the Civil War, James McPherson, has said that there isn't much about the Civil War that we don't know, but there are a lot of things that we don't know fully, and foreign affairs is one of those things. And I'll tell you one of the interesting things, I think this is fascinating, why there's been such a boom in Lincoln scholarship in recent years in terms of the quality of the stuff, not just the quantity, is that Lincoln scholars have gone to the papers of past historians of Lincoln and the Civil War and kind of combed through their note cards and found things that have ended up on the cutting room floor, which has added to our understanding. Because I could go to these papers and look at these things through the lens of foreign policy and pick things out that I hadn't seen other places. And to give you just one example, Mary Lincoln's role was something that I was surprised by. I mean, we have this kind of this view of Mary Lincoln as a difficult person who had a difficult life, but she was, what we forget is that she was actually more cosmopolitan than Lincoln in a lot of ways. She grew up in this house in Kentucky, which was considered it was called the Athens of the West at that time. She went to a school where the students spoke French. So she and her family, the Todds, kind of lorded this over Lincoln, and Lincoln liked to say, 1D was good enough for God, but not for the Todds. You know, they let him know that they were more cosmopolitan, and Mary actually interfered in diplomatic appointments to some degree. She tried to get her candidates appointed to consulships in Scotland and in the Sandwich Islands, which is modern-day Hawaii. Sometimes she was successful at it, sometimes she wasn't, but this is something that came out partly from going to these papers of past Mary Lincoln biographers that are now in places, university libraries and the Library of Congress.
Well, there had to be people wondering from abroad when they saw the Civil War taking place, the fight over slavery in the U.S. There had to be people wondering if the U.S. was just coming apart at the seams, probably people in this country who thought the same thing. Did that hurt Lincoln's ability to have a foreign policy and have relationships with people outside of the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, there was a kind of visceral gleefulness, especially from aristocratic Britons and Frenchmen who kind of enjoyed seeing the trouble in the across the Atlantic, and the British Prime Minister liked to kind of crow about the disunited States of America, he would call them, and after Bull Run he would talk about Yankees Run. That's the phrase that he would use. But I think when cooler heads kind of considered the issue, they realized that they didn't really have much of an interest in intervening in the war. There were some kind of profound commercial, trade, financial ties with Britain, for one. Britain was the United States' largest creditor, so it wasn't necessarily in British interests to kind of rupture those emerging bonds. I think what Lincoln was really good at is recognizing what the true interests of these European powers really were, and then not doing anything to mess them up.
Well, you'd also point out that Lincoln was respected by many of the foreign contemporaries as well, people of that time, including Karl Marx. They may not have been avid supporters necessarily of Lincoln on everything, but they certainly had he had their respect.
Marx was an interesting figure. I wouldn't say Marx respected Lincoln at the beginning of the war, but Marx, just by way of background, I mean, he was a journalist living in exile in London at this time. He was writing for, at the beginning of the war at least, for the New York Tribune, which had a circulation of 200,000 in the United States. So Lincoln may well have read some of the things that Marx was writing. Marx wrote about 300 or 400 articles for the Tribune, and Lincoln read the Tribune religiously. So he never said, "I read this article by Karl Marx," and a lot of the articles were not byline, but he may well have. Marx viewed the Civil War, he was watching it very carefully, and Marx believed that if the bourgeois union could triumph over the Southern aristocracy, then the United States was that much closer to the proletariat, the workers triumphing over both. So he wanted the Union to win for a different reason than Lincoln did, and he didn't particularly respect Lincoln as a leader, but by the end of the war, he certainly talked like he did, and he had come to see that Lincoln was a useful figure, and European workers sometimes rallied around the image of Lincoln, the liberator, One of the things that I think is interesting is that the similarities in the times. The mid-19th century was a period of globalization, essentially. It was the advent of the telegraph and the steamship, and there was a major boom in newspaper readership. And so so the world was shrinking, not unlike our own world. At the same time, it was an age of nationalism. Otto von Bismarck took power as prime minister in Prussia in 1862. Palmerston, the prime minister of Britain. On the one hand, it's an age of kind of hard-headed realism, an age of nationalism where nations are competing pretty vigorously on the world stage. But the overlay is this world where the world is shrinking national ties are becoming closer than ever. And so in that way, I think it resembles our contemporary globes.
That's Kevin Perino, the author of Lincoln in the World. Perino served as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek. Many schools are looking to expand mental health services to help with the trauma of 2020. Peter Medlin has more on an option that's popular with just about everyone.
Boomer wanders the halls at Immaculate Conception School in Morris, wearing a red vest that reads Therapy Dog in Training. He's a Great Pyrenees, so even at just a year old, he's already clocking in at over 100 pounds and sits nose to nose with kindergartners. Boomer's owner, school principal Stacy Swanson, says during the pandemic they needed other ways to help students starting to return in person.
And so I started looking at possibly, because we can't afford a therapist for school or a counselor or any of that type of thing here in a Catholic school.
Doctors have found all sorts of new ways to utilize support animals as of late, in physical and speech therapy and even in substance abuse programs. Swanson says Immaculate Conception uses Boomer in both ways therapy dogs are typically used in schools, stress relief and reading support. Boomer even got a picture on the staff page of the yearbook. Often high schools and colleges bring in dogs around final exams to let stressed out students pet their worries away. And with younger kids, the animals can give struggling students a comfortable way to practice reading with their furry friends as the audience. Trudy Delorier knows a thing or two about reading support. She's taught reading intervention to elementary school students for years, along with her golden retrievers, Martha and Thelma Lou. COVID-19 kept the dogs at home for most of the year. Delorier tried bringing them into the school once or twice in the fall, but she said even the kids were hesitant because of safety protocols. The Goldens made their grand return this spring.
The kids needed it. You know, our kids didn't get to have soccer and, you know, all the special events that you have in your classroom.
Delorier says the kids weren't the only ones glad to have the dogs back. The overwhelmed teachers and staff needed it too.
So it was unspoken that it's a mental health issue or a mental health crutch for them, but I felt that more adults were coming in to see the dogs, especially at the end of the year.
The school expects by fall they'll be able to hold events again where they can bring in over a dozen therapy dogs, including Martha and Thelma Lou, for the kids to read to once a month. During the pandemic, digital therapy dogs also took off. Not animated images of dogs, but students reading to real therapy dogs over Zoom. Carol Euster is the head of Canine Reading Buddies in Northern Illinois. She says even she wasn't sure if it would work. If the kids can't touch her, even be in the same room as the dog, can they get the same feeling?
The kids love it. The parents love it. Keeps the kids motivated to want to read.
Euster says the virtual program expanded to up to 100 sessions a month by this spring.
When a child signs up, the team sends an email on behalf of the dog telling the child they're excited to hear them read, and there's a picture. And then when the session is over, the team sends an email from the dog.
She says the digital dogs aren't going anywhere either, even though they've been able to hold a few in-person events since.
Some of the kids that were our virtual readers actually came to read to the dog they've been reading to on Zoom, and that brought tears to the parents' eyes.
They're looking forward to getting back to the 20-plus suburban schools the Reading Buddies work with. She's not sure if there's going to be an increased demand for therapy dogs this fall, but she thinks elevating the conversation around mental health in schools does open the door for more ways to utilize dogs.
And maybe we'll see even more after the pandemic, where teachers go for training to be a handler for a service dog And that service dog is on site, you know, in the counselor area when kids, you know, need support or they need to diffuse a situation that can be providing a calming moment for a child.
Not every dog is meant to be a therapy dog, but Euster says a dog with the right temperament can help create a positive school atmosphere for students of any age and their teachers. I'm Peter Medlin.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide, and we'll be back next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes. They're available at statewideshow.com, and you can also get our podcast through the NPR One app. Join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.